Chapter 18. His eyes with his hand, and began to speak. Three, you fellows knew enough of my early history to a guess what my second marriage meant to me. I say guess, because no one could understand really. I've always had a feminine streak in me, I suppose. The need of a pair of eyes that should see with me, of a pulse that should keep time with mine. Life is a big thing, of course. A magnificent spectacle, but I got so tired of looking at it alone. Still, it's always good to live, and I had plenty of happiness of the evolved kind. What I'd never had a taste of was the simple inconscient sort that one breathes in like the air. Well, I met her. It was like finding the climate in which I was meant to live. You know what she was, how indefinitely she multiplied one's points of contact with life, how she lit up the caverns, and bridged the abysses. Well, I swear to you, though I suppose the sense of all that was latent in me, that what I used to think of on my way home at the end of the day, was simply that when I opened this door she'd be sitting over there, with the lamplight falling in a particular way on one little curl in her neck. When Clayton painted her, he caught just the look she used to lift to mine. When I came in I wondered, sometimes, at his knowing how she looked when she and I were alone. How I rejoiced in that picture. I used to say to her, you're my prisoner now, I shall never lose you. If you grew tired of me, and left me, you'd leave your real self there on the wall. It was always one of our jokes, that she was going to grow tired of me, 3 years of it, and then she died. It was so sudden, that there was no change, no diminution. It was as if she had suddenly become fixed, immovable, like her own portrait. As if time had ceased at its happiest hour, just as Clayton had thrown down his brush one day and said, I can't do better than that. I went away, as you know, and stayed over there 5 years. I worked as hard as I knew how, and after the first black months a little light stole in on me. From thinking that she would have been interested in what I was doing, I came to feel that she was interested, that she was there, and that she knew. I'm not talking any psychical jargon, I'm simply trying to express the sense I had that an influence so full, so abounding as hers couldn't pass like a spring shower. We had so lived into each other's hearts and minds that the consciousness of what she would have thought and felt illuminated all I did. At first she used to come back shyly, tentatively, as though not sure of finding me. Then she stayed longer and longer, till at last she became again the very air I breathed. There were bad moments, of course, when her nearness mocked me with the loss of the real woman. But gradually the distinction between the two was effaced and the mere thought of her grew warm as flesh and blood. Then I came home. I landed in the morning, and came straight down here. The thought of seeing her portrait possessed me, and my heart beat like a lover's as I opened the library door. It was in the afternoon and the room was full of light. It fell on her picture, the picture of a young and radiant woman. She smiled at me coldly across the distance that divided us. I had the feeling that she didn't even recognize me. And then I caught sight of myself in the mirror over there, a gray-haired broken man whom she had never known. For a week we two lived together, the strange woman and the strange man. I used to sit night after night and question her smiling face, but no answer ever came. What did she know of me, after all? We were irrevocably separated by the 5 years of life that lay between us. At times, as I sat here, I almost grew to hate her. For her presence had driven away my gentle ghost, the real wife who had wept, aged, struggled with me during those awful years. It was the worst loneliness I've ever known. Then, gradually, I began to notice a look of sadness in the picture's eyes, a look that seemed to say, don't you see that I am lonely too? And all at once it came over me how she would have hated to be left behind. I remembered her comparing life to a heavy book that could not be read with ease unless two people held it together, and I thought how impatiently her hand would have turned the pages that divided us. So the idea came to me. It's the picture that stands between us, the picture that is dead, and not my wife. To sit in this room is to keep watch beside a corpse. Apostrophe as this feeling grew on me, the portrait became like a beautiful mausoleum in which as he had been buried alive. I could hear her beating against the painted walls, and crying to me faintly for help. One day I found I couldn't stand it any longer, and I sent for Clayton. He came down, and I told him what I'd been through, and what I wanted him to do. At first he refused point blank to touch the picture. The next morning I went off for a long tramp, and when I came home I found him sitting here alone. He looked at me sharply for a moment, and then he said, I've changed my mind. I'll do it. I arranged one of the north rooms as a studio, and he shut himself up there for a day. Then he sent for me. The picture stood there as you see it now. It was as though she'd met me on the threshold, and taken me in her arms. I tried to thank him, to tell him what it meant to me, but he cut me short. There's an up train at 5, isn't there? He asked. I'm booked for a dinner tonight. I shall just have time to make a bolt for the station and you can send my traps after me. I haven't seen him since. I can guess what it cost him to lay hands on his masterpiece. But, after all, to him it was only a picture lost, to me it was my wife regained. IV. After that, for 10 years or more, I watched the strange spectacle of a life of hopeful and productive effort based on the structure of a dream. There could be no doubt to those who saw Gramsci during this period that he drew his strength and courage from the sense of his wife's mystic participation in his task. When I went back to see him a few months later, I found the portrait had been removed from the library and placed in a small study upstairs, to which he had transferred his desk and a few books. He told me he always sat there when he was alone, keeping the library for his Sunday visitors. Those who missed the portrait, of course, made no comment on its absence, and the few who were in his secret respected it. Gradually all his old friends had gathered about him, and our Sunday afternoons regained something of their former character, but Clayton never reappeared among us. As I look back now, I see that Gramsci must have been failing from the time of his return home. His invincible spirit belied, and disguised the signs of weakness that afterward asserted themselves in my remembrance of him. He seemed to have an inexhaustible fund of life to draw on, and more than one of us was a pensioner on his superfluity. Nevertheless, when I came back one summer from my European holiday and heard that he had been at the point of death, I understood at once that we had believed him well only because he wished us to. I hastened down to the country and found him midway in a slow convalescence. I felt then that he was lost to us, and he read my thought at a glance. Ah, he said, I'm an old man now and no mistake. I suppose we shall have to go half speed after this, but we shan't need towing just yet. The plural pronoun struck me, and involuntarily I looked up at Mrs. Gramsci's portrait. Line by line I saw my fear reflected in it. It was the face of a woman who knows that her husband is dying. My heart stood still at the thought of what Clayton had done. Gramsci had followed my glance. Why yes, it's changed her, he said quietly. For months, you know, it was touch and go with me, we had a long fight of it, and it was worse for her than for me. After a pause he added, Colin Clayton has been very kind. He's so busy nowadays that I seldom see him, but when I sent for him the other day he came down at once. I was silent, and we spoke no more of Gramsci's illness, but when I took leave it seemed like shutting him in alone with his death warrant. The next time I went down to see him, he looked much better. It was a Sunday and he received me in the library, so that I did not see the portrait again. He continued to improve, and towards spring we began to feel that, as he had said, he might yet travel a long way without being towed. One evening, on returning to town after a visit which had confirmed my sense of reassurance, I found Clayton dining alone at the club. He asked me to join him, and over the coffee our talk turned to his work. If you're not too busy, I said at length, you ought to make time to go down to Grancy's again. He looked up quickly. Why? He asked. Because he's quite well again, I returned with a touch of cruelty. His wife's prognostications were mistaken. Clayton stared at me a moment. Oh, she knows, he affirmed with a smile that chilled me. You mean to leave the portrait as it is then? I persisted. He shrugged his shoulders. He hasn't sent for me yet. A waiter came up with the cigars and Clayton rose and joined another group. It was just a fortnight later that Grancy's housekeeper telegraphed for me. She met me at the station with the news that he had been again bad and that the doctors were with him. I had to wait for some time in the deserted library before the medical men appeared. They had the baffled manner of empirics who have been superseded by the great healer, and I lingered only long enough to hear that Grancy was not suffering, and that my presence could do him no harm. I found him seated in his armchair in the little study. He held out his hand with a smile. You see, she was right after all, he said. She? I repeated, perplexed for the moment. My wife. He indicated the picture. Of course I knew as he had no hope from the first. I saw that he lowered his voice, Sir Clayton had been here. But I wouldn't believe it at first. I caught his hands in mine. For God's sake, don't believe it now. I adjured him. He shook his head gently. It's too late, he said. I might have known that she knew. But, Grancy, listen to me, I began, and then I stopped. What could I say that would convince him? There was no common ground of argument on which we could meet, and after all it would be easier for him to die feeling that she had known. Strangely enough, I saw that Clayton had missed his mark. Grancy's will named me as one of his executors, and my associate, having other duties on his hands, begged me to assume the task of carrying out our friend's wishes. This placed me under the necessity of informing Clayton that the portrait of Mrs. Grancy had been bequeathed to him, and he replied by the next post that he would send for the picture at once. I was staying in the deserted house when the portrait was taken away, and as the door closed on it, I felt that Grancy's presence had vanished too. Was it his turn to follow her now, and could one ghost haunt another? After that, for a year or two, I heard nothing more of the picture, and though I met Clayton from time to time, we had little to say to each other. I had no definable grievance against the man, and I tried to remember that he had done a fine thing in sacrificing his best picture to a friend, but my resentment had all the tenacity of unreason. One day, however, a lady whose portrait he had just finished begged me to go with her to see it. To refuse was impossible, and I went with the less reluctance that I knew I was not the only friend as he had invited. The others were all grouped around the easel when I entered, and after contributing my share to the chorus of approval I turned away and began to stroll about the studio. Clayton was something of a collector, and his things were generally worth looking at. The studio was a long tapestried room with a curtained archway at one end. The curtains were looped back, showing a smaller apartment, with books and flowers and a few fine bits of bronze and porcelain. The tea table standing in this inner room proclaimed that it was open to inspection, and I wandered in. A blue powder vase first attracted me. Then I turned to examine a slender bronze Ganymede, and in so doing found myself face to face with Mrs. Grancy's portrait. I stared up at her blankly, and she smiled back at me in all the recovered radiance of youth. The artist had effaced every trace of his later touches, and the original picture had reappeared. It throned alone on the paneled wall, asserting a brilliant supremacy over its carefully chosen surroundings. I felt in an instant that the whole room was tributary to it. That Clayton had heaped his treasures at the feet of the woman he loved. Yes, it was the woman he had loved, and not the picture, and my instinctive resentment was explained. Suddenly I felt a hand on my shoulder. "Ah, how could you?" I cried, turning on him. "How could I?" he retorted. "How could I not? Doesn't she belong to me now?" I moved away impatiently. "Wait a moment," he said with a detaining gesture. "The others have gone, and I want to say a word to you. Oh, I know what you thought of me, I can guess. You think I killed Gramsci, I suppose?" I was startled by his sudden vehemence. I think you tried to do a cruel thing," I said. "Ah, what a little way you others see into life," he murmured. "Sit down a moment here, where we can look at her, and I'll tell you." He threw himself on the ottoman beside me, and sat gazing up at the picture, with his hands clasped about his knee. "Pygmalion," he began slowly, "turned his statue into a real woman. I turned my real woman into a picture. Small compensation, you think, but you don't know how much of a woman belongs to you after you've painted her. Well, I made the best of it. At any rate, I gave her the best I had in me, and she gave me in return what such a woman gives by merely being. And after all, she rewarded me enough by making me paint as I shall never paint again. There was one side of her, though, that was mine alone, and that was her beauty, for no one else understood it. To Gramsci, even it was the mere expression of herself. What language is to thought? Even when he saw the picture, he didn't guess my secret. He was so sure she was all his. As though a man should think he owned the moon, because it was reflected in the pool at his door. Well, when he came home and sent for me to change the picture, it was like asking me to commit murder. He wanted me to make an old woman of her who had been so divinely, unchangeably young. As if any man who really loved a woman would ask her to sacrifice her youth and beauty for his sake. At first I told him I couldn't do it, but afterward, when he left me alone with the picture, something queer happened. I suppose it was because I was always so confoundedly fond of Gramsci that it went against me to refuse what he asked. Anyhow, as I sat looking up at her, she seemed to say, "I'm not yours but his, and I want you to make me what he wishes." And so I did it. I could have cut my hand off when the work was done. I dare say he told you I never would go back and look at it. He thought I was too busy. He never understood. Well, and then last year he sent for me again, you remember. It was after his illness, and he told me he'd grown 20 years older, and that he wanted her to grow older too. He didn't want her to be left behind. The doctors all thought he was going to get well at that time, and he thought so too. And so did I, when I first looked at him. But when I turned to the picture, now I don't ask you to believe me, but I swear it was her face that told me he was dying, and that she wanted him to know it. As he had a message for him, and she made me deliver it. He rose abruptly, and walked toward the portrait. Then he sat down beside me again. Cruel? Yes, it seemed so to me at first. And this time, if I resisted, it was for his sake, and not for mine. But all the while I felt her. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.